Hello and welcome. You're listening to the podcast one for the lecture on propositional logic. As usually, there are recommendations for reading on slide 2. So now we are in our textbook in chapter 7 called Logical Agents. We go a little deeper than the textbook, and sometimes we also have a more formal treatment of the material. So here you can actually find more material in the Handbook of Satisfiability. You can download this handbook for free from the internet. And if you want to read a little more, then in particular take a look at some material that is discussed in chapters 1 to 4. Our agenda for today is shown on slide 3. So we will first introduce propositional logic, and we describe its syntax, its semantics, and we will also define so-called conjunctive and disjunctive normal forms for logical formulas. In the second part of this lecture, we will look into how reasoning and propositional logic works. We introduce basic terminology that we use to describe algorithms. Then we will learn about an algorithm that is called resolution. Finally, look into the Davis-Putnam-Loschmidt-Loveland algorithm, DPLL. And at the end, learn about an important technique that helps logical reasoning algorithms to scale up in a powerful way. And this technique is called conflict clause learning, or more precisely, conflict-driven clause learning. Slide 4 motivates this lecture. So we've looked already at the capabilities of a goal-based agent. And it first is able to perceive the environment, and then it uses these observations to make decisions. So from observing the state, the agent reasons to find out how the world is like now, because this will then later also lead the agent to take certain actions. The question is, how does this reasoning happen and proceed, and what mathematical methods can we use to actually capture the type of reasoning that we need here? Let's start with a more elaborate example on slide 5. So the textbook introduces the so-called Wumpus world, and I will simply also often speak of the Wumpus, so to use the German pronunciation. So the Wumpus world is a grid world, as we have seen it already in earlier lectures, for example, for our little vacuum cleaner. In this world, we find different elements. So in particular, there are pits, and of course, when we visit this world, it is dangerous to fall into these pits. On the other hand, there is gold, and we are interested in getting the gold. However, the gold is watched by the Wumpus. So the Wumpus is an unknown, maybe animal, we don't really know what it is, but it can be dangerous. So when the agent tries to get the gold, the Wumpus can attack the agent. The world is not fully specified in the textbook, but we will fill in some details here in this lecture. So the agent can notice the Wumpus through some stench, but only when the agent is very near to the Wumpus in an adjacent cell. Our agent is armed, it has exactly one arrow, and it can shoot this single arrow, but not more. And it has the goal of finding the gold and, of course, leave the cave alive. So in this world, certain rules hold that determine what actually happens to the agent. So first, the agent dies if it steps onto a cell with the Wumpus or a cell with a pit. The agent can also only shoot into the direction it is facing, and it can only leave the cave via the cell where it actually enters, namely cell 1-1. The Wumpus is in a cell next to the gold to guard it, and we cannot enter the field with the gold if the Wumpus is alive. The locations of pits, gold, and Wumpus are initially unknown to the agent. So our agent can actually perceive certain properties of the world. So for example, it can notice a stench. So when the agent is on a cell adjacent to the Wumpus, then there will be stench. Furthermore, the agent can notice pits. So when the agent is on a cell adjacent to a pit, there will be a breeze. Then there is glitter. So we can see the gold once we are on the cell where the gold is located. Our agent cannot really see walls in this wall, but when the agent walks into a wall, there will be a bump, so it can actually touch these walls then and stays in the cell where it currently is. And the agent can also hear a scream. When the Wumpus is hit by the arrow, then there will be a scream. Our agent can also execute actions, as shown on slide 8. So it can go forward one cell in the direction it is facing. It can turn left and right, so which also means it can only turn always by 90 degrees, but it can turn in both directions. And it can grab an object in the current cell, which is the gold, and it can also shoot the arrow. And now the big question is, of course, how can the agent safely explore the cave and find the gold? And we will start exploring how this is possible and how mathematical logic can help here on the next slides. So let's first talk about the initial state on slide 9. So what does the agent know initially? The agent is in the cell next to the entry of the cave. It is facing east. There are no percepts, so there is no stench, no breeze, no glitter. So now the agent can actually draw some conclusions, namely that the neighboring cells are safe. So if as there is no stench, so the Wumpus cannot be on a neighboring cell. There is also no breeze, so there is no pit also on any of these cells. And as we do not notice any glitter, then we also know that there is no gold on the current cell where we are. However, it could always be possible that maybe there is gold in one of the neighboring cells because we can only notice the gold once we are there. You see from the picture that actually this grid world has no lower cell at the bottom. So in this situation, the agent can go forward to the next cell or it can go upward to another cell. But however, it cannot see if there are other cells, for example, further down. So how can it actually know that there is no cell in this direction? Well, it has to execute some action. So it would turn right, then move forward, and then there would be a bump. So now let's assume the agent has done this, realized that it can only move forward or upward, and for some reason it now decides to move forward, as shown on slide 10. So moving forward is one of the two safe actions the agent has available. So let's now assume that the agent moves to cell 2-1. So now in this cell, the agent notices a breeze. So this means a pit must be in a neighboring cell. So this can be on top of the agent or forward of the agent. In principle, it could also be down, but we assume that the agent then had turned, bumped into a wall and knows that there is no other cave at the bottom. The agent does not notice glitter or stench. So there is no Wumpus in the neighboring cell, and there is also no gold in this cell. So now our agent faces a dilemma. It can safely go back, but it cannot go up or move forward without risking to fall in a pit. So what the agent decides now is actually that it needs to back up and re-explore other remaining safe cells. So on slide 11, we look at the situation once the agent has turned left twice, it has moved forward, it has turned right again and moved forward again. So this has brought the agent up to the upper cell next to the entrance of the cave. So in this cell, the agent notices no breeze, no glitter, but it knows this is a stench. So this means that the Wumpus must be very nearby. And actually, the Wumpus is now in the cell that the agent is facing. So how can the agent know? Well, we did not notice any stench in the lower second cave when the agent first moved forward. So this means that the Wumpus cannot be in the cell right to the agent. So as we now notice a stench, we can be sure that the Wumpus actually must be in the cell above the agent. So this also then means that the gold must be somewhere nearby, because the Wumpus is always in a cell next to the gold. However, the gold will not be next to the agent, because the Wumpus must always be next to the gold in vertical or horizontal direction. Now we can also conclude that there is no pit in the right cell of the agent, because we do not notice a breeze. So this also allows us to determine that the pit must be actually in the lowest row of caves, as shown in the picture. So this means our agent can actually move safely to the next cell. So it can turn right and move forward. So now the agent does not notice any stench anymore. As we do not notice any stench, but we noticed stench earlier, we now know that actually the Wumpus must be in the upper cell. So now our agent can actually turn twice, move forward again, so go back to the previous cell, turn right to face in the direction of the Wumpus and shoot the arrow. So if the conclusions of our agent were correct, it should actually hear a scream. So now the agent can move to the cell with the gold, grab the gold and leave the cave. Of course, it still needs to wander a little bit around, because it knows not exactly if the gold is on the right hand of the Wumpus or if it's in the cell above the Wumpus. Slide 13 introduces the rational thinking agent, which has a knowledge base abbreviated with KB. So this agent has a persistent memory where it stores knowledge about the world. It has a counter that indicates time. So again, we look at discrete actions and discrete state spaces. So if the agent makes a percept, it analyzes this percept and adds some new knowledge to its knowledge base on time t using the function tell. It has also available a function ask, where on time t it can access the knowledge base to find out what action it should actually choose next. It can also store this action in the knowledge base again. So it then advances time by one and returns the action. So next we will see how mathematical logic helps us with a method to formalize this kind of thinking of the agent. So we will keep the knowledge base in logic, and we will automate the thinking by a logical calculus. In our case, this will be the calculus of propositional logic. Slide 14 summarizes what we will do next. So first, we define the syntax of the logic. The syntax defines what are the structurally legal statements, so-called formulas, in this logical language. Then we assign a meaning to these formulas by defining the semantics. Finally, we define a calculus, so we need to formulate rules and methods that allow us to reason about formulas. For example, we want to know which formulas are true or false in our knowledge base, and we also want to know if a formula follows from another formula or set of formulas. So let's proceed with the syntax of propositional logic on slide 15. Let sigma be a set of Boolean variables, so-called atomic propositions. Based on these Boolean variables, we define two specific sigma formulas, which we call false and true, and we also denote false by the symbol of bottom and true by the symbol of top. Each atomic proposition in sigma is a so-called sigma formula. If phi is a sigma formula, then the negation of phi is a sigma formula. If psi and phi and psi are sigma formulas, then we can define the conjunction phi and psi, the disjunction phi or psi, the implication phi implies psi, and the equivalence phi if and only if psi. We also consider the atomic propositions, or for short denoted as atoms, and the negated atoms as so-called literals. So when we later speak of literals, you know that we have an atomic formula or a negated atomic formula. Slide 16 shows you the grammar and Backus-Naur formalism for propositional logic and how we can make up more complex sentences starting from the atomic sentences and our logical connectives. Operators or logical connectives in the logic have a clearly defined precedence. Very important is the so-called implication. So we use the implication phi implies psi to describe rules. So if the premise or antecedent of the implication holds, then we can conclude the consequent of it. We also call this if-then-else statements. And they will play a particular role, for example, to formalize the rules that hold for the Wumpus world. Slide 17 introduces further constructs of this logic. So we define sentences, literals, and clauses. As we already mentioned earlier, a literal is an atomic proposition, or short atom, or the negation of an atom. Examples are, for example, the atom X1 or not X1. A clause is a disjunction of literals. So we can, for example, have the clause X1 or X2, or the clause not X1 or X2 or not X3. A sentence is any atomic proposition or complex proposition. Atomic propositions, as said before, are also called literal. As an example, we see here an implication. So if X1 or X2 hold, we can conclude that not X1 or X2 or not X3 is valid and holds as well. Another example is the sentence or logical formula X1 or X2 and not X1 or not X3. So with this, we have defined the semantics of our logic. So now let's move on to the definition of the semantics on slide 18. The semantics of a logic defines the rules for determining the truth value of a sentence with respect to a so-called interpretation, which assigns truth values to every proposition. So now let sigma be a set of atomic proposition. An interpretation I of sigma is called a truth assignment. It is defined a function that assigns to each proposition the value of 0, 1. Slide 19 shows how the interpretation of the logical propositions is defined for propositional logic. An interpretation always assigns true to the true symbol, so to top. It assigns false to the bottom symbol, so it does not satisfy false. The interpretation or P is valid in this interpretation if the interpretation of any symbol in P leads to an assignment of the value true for pi. An interpretation satisfies or entails the formula not phi if it does not entail or satisfy the formula phi. We also sometimes speak in the same way that the interpretation I is a model of a formula phi. So phi and psi is true in this interpretation if both of them are true. The disjunction is true if one of the disjuncts is true or satisfied by the interpretation, or if I entails one of the disjuncts. I satisfies an implication if it satisfies the antecedent, and then also satisfies the consequent, and it satisfies an equivalence if it satisfies the two parts of the equivalence in exactly the same way. So for each formula, we can construct a set of satisfying interpretations, and we call this the set of all models. And this is denoted by M. So M of phi denotes all interpretations which satisfy phi. So let's look on slide 20 to make this more clear. Alternative and very intuitive representation is the truth table that we can write down for the basic connectives. So we start with two formulas, phi and psi, which are atomic propositions. And now we enumerate all possible combinations of truth values for these formulas. So both atoms can be either true, one of them can be false, or they can both be false. So we have here a binary logic, so we only know the truth values of true and false. Other logics which work with more than two values also exist, but simple propositional logic also considers two possible truth values. So with these two values and two formulas, we actually get these four different combinations. So the negation of phi is just the opposite truth value. So if phi is true, then not phi is false, and vice versa. So the conjunction is now defined that it is true when both are true. So phi and psi must both be assigned the value true. In all other cases, the conjunction of phi and psi is false. The disjunction is defined in the opposite way. So it's true if at least one of the two disjuncts is true, and false is if both are false. For the implication, we define that it is true if we conclude from a true formula to a true formula, or if we conclude from a false formula to a truth formula, or both are false. So a implication is only false if the antecedent is true, but we actually make a conclusion which is assigned the value false. So this also corresponds what you would intuitively imagine. The equivalence phi, if and only if psi is true, if both parts of the formula have the same truth value. So now, based on this table, for example, we can actually compute the whether an interpretation actually satisfies a more complex formula. So this is shown on slide 21. So note that we actually use the letters true or false, F or T, synonymously with the numbers 0 and 1. So here I show the example derivation using 1 to stand for true and 0 to stand for false. So let's assume that we first assign certain truth values to our atoms. So we need to start with a truth evaluation of the atomic propositions. This gives us, for example, 1 for pi and 1 for q. And it gives us 0 for r and 0 for s. So now we can actually start computing the values for the more complex formulas. So the disjunction pi or q is true when both are true. So this gives us a 1. It is false when both are false. So this gives us a 0 for r or s. So now we can actually look at the equivalence between these two terms, and we see they have different truth values assigned. So this means that the equivalent is actually false, so we also assign it 0. Now let's look at the second part of this conjunction. So we know that P is true, Q is true, R is false, and S is also false. So this means that not S is actually 1. So here we have two conjuncts. So P and Q is one true because both are true, but R and not S is false because R is false. So now we can look at the negated formula, not P and Q. So as P and Q is true, the negation is false, so we assign it for a 0. Now we have actually computed the truth values for both conjuncts, and we can look at the entire second part of this formula, and we see it's actually false. So it's we assign it a 0. The first conjunct also actually was false. And so now we actually know that our interpretation, which assigned 1 to P and Q, and R and S were assigned 0, does not satisfy this formula. And actually, we've known this already much earlier, because we know that a conjunction can only be true if both conjuncts are true. So we could also have stopped after computing the truth value 0 for the first part of this conjunction, because whatever the outcome for the second part is, we know that the interpretation will assign false to this formula phi. So let's look a little bit more into terminology on slide 22. A knowledge base is a conjunction or a set of formulas. An interpretation is a model for the formula if it makes all formulas or sentences, also called sometimes, true. So each formula in the knowledge base must be true, and then this interpretation is a model of the knowledge base. So what can we say about the truth status of a formula? A formula phi is satisfiable if and only if there exists an interpretation that satisfies phi. It is unsatisfiable if phi is not satisfiable. So this means there is no interpretation at all that would satisfy this formula phi. A formula is falsifiable if and only if there exists an interpretation that doesn't satisfy phi. So we find an assignment of truth values to the atomic propositions or the literals in the atomic propositions in the formula phi that actually leads to an assignment of false to the entire formula. A formula phi is valid if and only the formula holds in all interpretations. So whatever truth values we assign to the atoms in phi, then we actually have a true interpretation. So then we also call phi a tautology. We can now also state when two formulas are equivalent. They are equivalent if they have the same models. So this means they have the same set of satisfying interpretations. Slide 23 summarizes important equivalences that hold in propositional logic. So where actually the truth values and of the formulas are identical. So if you negate a formula phi twice, then you actually obtain the original formula. In line 2 and 3, we list the so-called laws of De Morgan. So these laws allow us to move in a negation. So we have a conjunction or disjunction of two formulas. This is guarded by a negation, and now we can move this negation in to precede directly the formulas. And you can see that the conjunction or disjunction in the middle always flips then to the other value. So the negation of a formula phi and psi is the formula not phi or not psi. You can actually validate these equivalences if you fill out the truth tables for both formulas. So start again with assigning all possible value combinations to phi and psi, and then compute the truth value for the formula on the right and the truth value for the formula on the left. And you will see that they always in each line have the same values. That's why they are equivalent, and their set of models and truth satisfying interpretations is the same. So then in line 4, you see that you can actually split up an equivalence into a conjunction of implications, and you can also replace the implication by a disjunction. Furthermore, we formulate the laws of distributivity for a combination of a conjunct and a disjunct in line 6 and 7. So now let's look into normal forms. So when you look at these equivalences on slide 23, you actually notice that we only need negation and disjunction and conjunction to actually express all formulas. So implication and equivalence can always be replaced by formulas expressed only with these connectives. So this leads us to the definition of two very important so-called normal forms or normal form representation for formulas in propositional logic on slide 24. So we say that a formula is a conjunctive normal form if it consists of a conjunction of disjunction of literals. So we have a conjunction at the outermost connective, and which links together a number of disjuncts, and each of these disjuncts only contains atoms or negations of atoms. Similarly, we can define the disjunctive normal form. So this one consists of a disjunction of conjunctions of literals. Let's look at an example on slide 25. We have given an implication. So we have an antecedent, which is P or Q and not Q, and it implies pi. So now let's use the equivalences which we defined on slide 23 and change this formula and transform it into conjunctive and disjunctive normal form. So the first what we can do is to replace the implication symbol. So this leads us to the negated antecedent and then followed pi as a second disjunction. So from x implies x implies y, we can equivalently transform this into not x or y. So now we actually use our first equivalence and start moving the negation inward. So we move it in front of pi or q, we also move it over the conjunction, which changes into a disjunction, and we get a double negated q. the second part of the formula over pi remains unchanged. So we can remove this double negation in front of q, because we obtain q again as equivalent expression, and now we move the negation in front of pi or q inward, so we get not pi and not q. So note that disjunction changes to conjunction. So now we actually have a formula in disjunctive normal form. So we have a disjunction of three formulas which only contain literals and conjunction. So q and p are atoms, and then we have the formula left, not p and not q. So this is immediately the representation that we need for the disjunctive normal form. So to obtain a conjunctive normal form, we need to apply the laws of distributivity. And this helps us to actually kind of multiply the formulas, and it leads to the conjunction that you see at the bottom of our derivation. And then I encourage you to go through this and practice how you actually apply the distributivity law here to the formula to arrive at the conjunctive normal form. So with this, let me end this first podcast for the lecture on propositional logic.